Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Fitzpatrick, do we have a motion?
I do, Your Honor, and I'd ask the law clerks to come up here. We're being admitted this morning, and if, when I call your name, if you would step forward so that the judges will know who you are. But come on up here. You can line up behind me as well. This way. Fine. It's a real honor and privilege to be before Your Honors this morning on a very happy occasion to move the admission of the law clerks for the court. Carolyn Anderson is a law clerk to Judge Flum, and she received her undergraduate degree from Stanford, and her law degree is from Harvard, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Elizabeth Austin received her undergraduate and her law school degree from the University of Chicago. She's a clerk to Chief Judge Easterbrook and is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Russell Balikian is an undergraduate. He has his undergraduate degree from Taylor University. His law degree is from Yale, and he's a clerk to Judge Sykes, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Aaron Kraft is a law clerk to Judge Tinder. He received his degree in pharmacy from Purdue University College of Pharmacy. His law school degree is from the Indiana University Maurer School of Law, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Indiana. Gail Eisenberg is a staff law clerk who received her undergraduate and her master's degree from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And her law degree is from Northwestern, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Danielle Evans is a law clerk to Judge Wood, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Maryland. Her undergraduate degree is from the University of Miami, and her law degree is from Yale. Sylvia Ewald is a staff law clerk who received her undergraduate degree from the University of California in Berkeley. Her law school degree is from Columbia, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Samuel Gilbert received his undergraduate degree from McGill. His law school degree is from George Washington Law School. He's a staff law clerk, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Allison Howlett received her undergraduate degree from DePaul. Her law school degree is from Loyola. She's a clerk to Judge Bauer, and she's admitted to practice in Illinois. And she's a brand-new mother. Maren Holden received her undergraduate degree from the University of Chicago. Her law school degree is from Columbia. She's a clerk to Judge Tinder, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois.
Correction. Clerk for Judge Hamilton.
Happy to have her.
Thank you.
All those people from Indiana look alike anyway.
Peter Jaffe received his undergraduate degree from Stanford, and his law school degree is from Georgetown, and he's a law clerk to Judge Sykes and is admitted to practice in the state of New York. Laura Jarrett is a law clerk to Judge Williams, received her undergraduate degree from Amherst, her law degree from Harvard, and is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Lee Cranbuehl is a law clerk to Judge Flum. She received her undergraduate degree from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She's a graduate of the Duke University School of Law, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. David Levine received his undergraduate degree from Bard College and Michigan State University, and her law degree is from University of Michigan. She's a law clerk to Judge Caney, and is admitted to practice in the state of Massachusetts. Ross McSweeney received his undergraduate degree from Columbia. His law school degree is from the University of Chicago. He's a clerk to Chief Judge Easterbrook and is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Ryan Melcher received his undergraduate degree from Wayne State University. His law school degree is from the University of Iowa. He's a staff law clerk, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Benjamin Mooneyham received his undergraduate degree from Kansas State University. His law school degree is from the University of Chicago. He's a staff law clerk, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Missouri. Ryan Moorman is a clerk for Judge Flum. who received his undergraduate degree from Washington and Jefferson College. His law school degree is from Northwestern, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Eric Nitz received his undergraduate degree from Notre Dame. His law school degree is from Georgetown. He's admitted to practice in both Virginia and the District of Columbia, and he's a clerk for Judge Flum. Ashley Nyquist is another clerk for Judge Sykes, who received her undergraduate degree from Yale. Her law school degree is from Harvard, and she's admitted to practice in the state of New York. David Pelko received his undergraduate degree from Davidson College. His law school degree is from Harvard. He's a law clerk to Judge Caney, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Maryland. Nicole Pepperell received her undergraduate degree from Stanford. Her law school degree is from Harvard. She's a staff law clerk, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Kevin Reedy received his undergraduate degree from Boston College. His law degree is from the University of Michigan. He's a law clerk to Judge Williams, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Timothy Shapiro is a law clerk to Judge Posner. Received his undergraduate degree from Amherst College. His law school degree is from Stanford, and he's admitted to practice in the state of California. Jennifer Chenal received her undergraduate degree from Harvard, double major in history and economics. A law school degree is from Vanderbilt, and she has a PhD from Vanderbilt, both in law and economics. And she is a law clerk to Judge Tinder, and admitted to practice in the state of Tennessee. David Simpson received his undergraduate and his law school degree at Stanford. He's a clerk for Judge Caney. He's admitted to practice in Illinois and California. And one of the things that you might not have picked up on is that these three law clerks for Judge Caney are known as the House of David. This was a year on Oscar. If you applied and your name was David, it improved your chances to clerk for Judge Caney. Matthew Singer received his undergraduate degree from the University of Michigan. His law school degree is from Harvard. He's a staff law clerk, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Thomas Traxler, Jr. received his undergraduate degree from the University of South Carolina. His law school degree is from Vanderbilt. He's a law clerk to Judge Sykes, and he's admitted to practice in the state of South Carolina.
Collins, it's the other way around.
Okay.
Undergraduate degree from Vanderbilt.
Oh.
Law degree from South Carolina.
Okay. Thank you. Mary Eileen Wells received her undergraduate degree from Georgetown. Her law school degree is from Stanford. She's a law clerk to Judge Bauer. She's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois, and unlike her co-clerk, she's a recent mother as well.
The last 3 weeks, I might add.
Okay.
I take no personal credit for that.
Good. We're glad, Bill.
Joseph Wensinger received his undergraduate degree from Bowling Green State University. His law school degree is from the University of Michigan. He's a staff law clerk, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Charles Weislong is a law clerk to Judge Posner, who received his undergraduate degree from the University of Chicago. His law school degree is from Stanford, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Sean Young received his undergraduate degree from Duke. His law degree is from Yale. He is a law clerk to Judge Williams, and he's admitted to practice in the state of New York. Your Honors, I move their admission.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fitzpatrick. Your motion is granted. Before you take the oath from the clerk, I want to welcome you on behalf of the court. We've enjoyed working with you so far this year. We look forward to the rest of your time with us, and then to many years of successful practice at our bar and the bars of the other courts where you may practice. So if you will turn over in that direction and take the oath from the clerk.
Raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that you will demean yourself as the attorney and counselor of this court uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States?
I do.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We're ready to hear argument now in the case of United States against Phillips. Mr. Wilson.
Good morning. May it please the court, Eric Wilson on behalf of the appellants Aaron Hall and Lacey Phillips. We are here today to decide whether Mr. Hall and Ms. Phillips received a fair trial. We are not here today to decide whether they were guilty or innocent. Rather, the court must decide whether they received a fair trial. And we would respectfully submit that they most certainly did not. The court did not allow them to present evidence that was directly relevant to their intent. The issue here was whether they submitted a loan application containing particular false statements with the intent that those false statements influence the lender. The fundamental error that both the district court and the government made over and over and over again during the district court proceedings that warped the entire trial was that what was in Mr. Hall and Ms. Phillips' head, their beliefs about what was or was not important to the lender, was irrelevant. In doing so, the district court essentially read the specific intent element right out of the statute. In fact, the government and the district court essentially treated the intent element as nothing more than a jurisdictional element. You just need to submit a loan application to get a home loan.
This wasn't the first loan application they made, was it? On that same piece of property?
Yes, it was.
They never made it a prior application for a loan?
That's correct, Judge Bauer. They had visited Associated Bank immediately prior to going to Mr. Bowling, but they never filled out a loan application at that bank.
They discussed the loan application at the first bank.
No, they did not. They never saw a loan application.
Never talked about it.
Never talked about it.
Why did they go?
They went to try to get a loan. And they gave...
They didn't talk about it.
They didn't talk about the loan application, Judge.
What did they talk about?
They gave their Social Security number to the loan officer. He ran a quick credit check and told Mr. Hall and Ms. Phillips that although your combined income might qualify you for a loan, and that's important because it goes to their intent about whether they reasonably believe they could get this loan with a combined income. He said, although your combined income might qualify you, Mr. Hall's credit score means you can't get a loan. They never filled out a loan application. They never saw a loan application prior to dealing with Mr. Bowling. And so, in effect, the district court read the intent element out of the statute. We submit that that requires reversal and a new trial for Mr. Hall and Ms. Phillips.
Let me ask you this question, Mr. Wilson. I understand the distinction that you're drawing between the purpose in their mind and whatever the bank might have been thinking over on its side. And I understand that those are two different things. But what is worrying me about this is the question whether, on the particular facts of this case, there's enough evidence in the record to justify this new trial that you're asking for. I can imagine, for instance, if they deliberately put down in the form a false weight, maybe just out of vanity or something, and they had no purpose to influence, that you would say, well, you shouldn't tell them that they violated the statute just because they submitted this document with a false statement to the bank. The weight is, unless the bank is really on a total health kick that it only gives loans to people with healthy weights, it's not something. But I think the problem a lot of people have is when it's the income and when the statement is not just combining but then doubling, what's the evidence that their purpose was anything but to get the loan? Focusing on their purpose.
Okay. Their purpose absolutely was to get a loan. But that's
with
not
that
the relevant...
false information, with that false information.
Well, see, right, Judge Wood. That is exactly the connection that the district court failed to make.
But I'm asking you, could On this particular set of facts, could any rational jury think that their purpose of putting $8,000 instead of maybe four was anything but to influence the lender to extend the loan?
Yes, absolutely. If the district court had allowed me to cross-examine Mr. Bowling about what he told the defendants, the jury absolutely could have believed that. And there is a lengthy record, both in the writ submissions prior to trial and in a lengthy prior pretrial hearing, where I was testing the judge's patience trying to make my record, where I told the judge that we want to cross-examine Brian Bowling about the fact that he told these defendants that this income won't matter to the bank. This income won't influence the bank. And she completely precluded me from asking those questions of Mr. Bowling. So
she may have misunderstood you, because that sounds like it's the bank's state of mind you're talking about. And you've stressed, and I'm accepting for right now, that it's their purpose that we're talking about. So I need some help linking those.
Okay. She did not misunderstand me. Here is a argument that I made at the pretrial hearing. Quoting me, to the extent that Mr. Bowling told Mr. Hall and Ms. Phillips what was or was not important to the banks, that is relevant to whether or not they intended to influence the banks. The district court's answer, and I quote, I'll deny your attempt to use that as a defense. She completely precluded me from both cross-examining Mr. Bowling about what he told the defendants, and then the district court precluded me from asking my own client what Mr. Bowling had told him about this whole stated loan program and whether the income would or would not influence the banks and what was or was not important to the banks.
Now, according to Agent Freitag, the defendant said that Bowling told him he was going to change Phillips' income and the job title on the loan application, you know, in order to make it look better. So even under a view of the evidence, that is favorable. Isn't it clear they knew that Bowling was misrepresenting key facts on the application?
We would suggest, and I promise myself that I would not stand here this morning and try to convince you they're innocent, because that's not my job. Although I firmly believe that, assume that they knew it was false. Assume they knew that the loan application contained a false number, that it contained an inflated job title. For purposes of today, you could assume that, okay?
I understand. They testified that he changed the... that Bowling changed the income figure that they...
That's right. I'm making a point for purposes of my argument this morning, Judge Posner. You're absolutely correct that a cornerstone of our defense was that they never knew that the application contained the false information that it did. My point is simply that even if they did know, they should be allowed to testify, and I should have been allowed to cross-examine Mr. Bowling, that information you told them wasn't important. Even if inaccurate, it wasn't important. It wasn't important to the bank.
And thus, you had to have wrapped it up. They couldn't have had any purpose. Their purpose couldn't have been to affect the bank, because it would have struck them as nothing more than the weight misstatement or an age misstatement.
That's absolutely correct, Judge Wood. And in fact, I think it's an important distinction to remember that what Brian Bowling thought, because remember, our clients didn't put anything on these loan applications. Mr. Bowling did everything. He put all of the information on the loan application. Ms. Phillips signed it. My client, Mr. Hall, never saw the loan application or signed a single document of the loan paperwork. So, she signed and initialed it. Correct. But I think it's important. Excuse me?
She signed it initially.
And initialed it. I'm sorry. So the particular page containing the false income figure and the inflated job title, that contained her initials, not her signature. But I think what's important to remember is that the question of whether Mr. Bowling put that information on the application to influence the bank is completely separate of whether the defendants themselves intended to influence the bank. Because the information that we were precluded from presenting to the jury was that Mr. Bowling told Mr. Hall and Ms. Phillips, first-time homebuyers, with neither of them containing more than a high school education, a barber and a hairdresser, that these details don't matter. What drives these stated income loans is your credit score. And you guys can qualify because we're going to combine your incomes. Everything else doesn't matter. So that's important not only to the intent to influence element, because he told them this won't influence it, but if you think about it, it's also relevant to the second element of whether she knowingly signed a false loan application. Because if you're told all of these details don't matter, it makes it more credible that you're going to sit there at the closing signing and initialing everything that's put before you without closely reviewing any of it, which was our defense, because Mr. Bowling had told them, don't worry, credit score is good, nothing else matters. And that's the defense that we were precluded from presenting to the jury. And incredibly, still, the government argues, despite the fact that there is an element in this statute that requires that the defendants act with the purpose of influencing the bank, that they intend that the particular false statement influence the bank, the government is still arguing that their subjective beliefs are irrelevant. It's incredible. Now, certainly, some of their subjective beliefs are irrelevant. If they had argued, we didn't intend to harm the bank, can't use that defense. If they had argued, we didn't intend to defraud the bank, you can't use that defense. But the defense we were arguing is, we didn't intend to influence the bank. And that's an element that's directly from the statute itself. And this whole notion of, well, Wells has held that materiality is not an element of the crime, so therefore materiality is never relevant, I would respectfully disagree with that. The statute itself sometimes does make materiality relevant because the wording of the statute itself requires that the government prove that the particular false statement was made for the purpose of influencing the bank.
But you're not saying materiality is directly relevant. It's only perhaps that in the Rule 401 sense, perhaps evidence of materiality might shed some light on purpose.
But only if the defendant knew it. Only if those notions of what was important or not important to the bank was communicated to the defendant. So the defendant can't argue like Vincent Lane did that this wasn't important to the bank. But to the extent that information had been communicated to Mr. Lane, that absolutely would have been a good argument for him to make. And this, in fact, I would argue that materiality and intent to influence are really just two sides of the same coin. Materiality from the perspective of the bank and intent to influence from the perspective of the borrower. Because Supreme Court jurisprudence often defines materiality by saying, did the statement have the capability of influencing? And so therefore, in presenting a defense, the defendant ought to be allowed to say, I didn't intend to influence the bank. Why?
Did you say anything about what I understood to be your alternative defense? Is that they did not knowingly make a false statement.
That's correct.
That's different from you.
It is. That's right. Because in order to succeed with our defense, we needed to explain to the jury why it was that Lacey and Aaron went into that closing knowing that only Lacey was going to sign the loan application, but they were going to get a $246,000 house. And the way we explained that to them is that we had gone to Associated Bank. Our clients went to Associated Bank, told them that their combined income was just sufficient, but that the credit score for Aaron wouldn't work. And so the defense, Judge Posner, was that Mr. Bowling had told Mr. Hall and Ms. Phillips that under this thing called the Stated Income Loan Program, which this is a complete lie, this is not what the program was, but what Mr. Bowling told them was that what this program does, it allows you to combine your income on the same loan application but leave the poor credit borrower off the application.
That's in the nature of a mistake of fact defense, and it looks from the record that the district court construed it in the nature of a mistake of law defense.
Right. So we would disagree with the district court's conclusion in that regard. The information that Mr. Bowling communicated to the defendants about what they needed to do to put on this loan application, those were facts about the loan application, about the stated income loan program. They may have had legal consequences, but just because they had legal consequences doesn't mean that it was a mistake of law that they made by walking into that loan closing thinking under this stated income loan program that Lacey alone could be on the loan application without Aaron signing it.
But Mr. Wilson, as I recall, you did not make an offer of proof on these facts that were excluded.
Not at trial, Your Honor.
Where can we find what the facts would have been that you say were excluded? What's the best representation that you made of that to the district court?
Under Rule 103, we were not required at trial to renew our offer of proof because we made one prior to trial and the judge ruled definitively on it. And if you review the written submissions that we tendered prior to trial and this lengthy transcript from the pretrial hearing, where, again, I was testing the judge's patience on this score, you will see numerous representations in there about what I told the judge I wanted to cross-examine.
Right. You wanted to cross-examine Bowling, but how do we know the answers would have helped your clients?
Submitted as part of our submissions in the district court were the 302s from Mr. Bowling. We had a reasonable basis.
Those were with your motion for new trial.
Right.
Post-trial submission.
Right.
But at the time, at the pretrial period, you didn't submit those 302s.
Right. But everyone in that courtroom, Judge Tinder, knew that I wanted to ask Mr. Bowling about what he told the defendants about what was or was not important to the bank. It was abundantly clear to the defense, to the prosecution, and the district court what evidence I wanted to get in. And so I would submit that there is a very good reason why the government has forfeited this argument by not raising it on appeal.
Back to important. That's a separate issue. The question is, did you hope that Bowling would acknowledge that what he told the applicants was that when the form asks for borrower's income, means the borrower's income plus any other income that will be available to pay the mortgage.
Right. But not only that.
What do you do with importance? That's just saying to them, this is what it means. It doesn't say that, but this is what it means. Right?
And that supports one aspect of our defense, correct?
And then at pretrial, you did represent to the court what your clients would say that Bowling said to them, correct?
We told the court that we wanted our clients to testify that the stated income loan program was a program where they could combine their incomes on one loan. And I would submit.
And also included in that was what Bowling told them, correct?
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
So, I mean, that is your offer proof. I'm just saying the evidence that you were anticipating getting, you were going to be able to get that evidence not only from your clients, but you hoped during the cross-examination of Bowling you would get that confirmed.
That's right, Judge Williams. It was not only that my cross-examination of the main cooperator, I mean, I did the cross with one arm tied behind my back because of this pretrial ruling that I couldn't ask him anything about what he told my client about what was or was not important to the bank. And I would submit that it's entirely reasonable for us to assume, and everyone knew what Mr. Bowling was going to say. Judge Posner asked Mr. Graber the last time we were here in this building on this case, what if he said it's fine because the banks don't care about these details? Mr. Graber's answer was, that's what he did say. He explained to them exactly that. That's what I wanted to ask Mr. Bowling on cross-examination. And if the jury had heard that evidence, that would have supported our defense, and we think the district court's error in now allowing us to present that evidence warrants a new trial. We're not asking you to decide today whether they are guilty or innocent. We're only asking that they have a new trial where the jury be allowed to hear their complete defense.
Wilson, did you frame some sort of theory of defense instruction?
No.
Your position is you were precluded from it?
I'll tell you the instruction we did tender, Your Honor, that was rejected, which is Here's the instruction that we tendered. Whether or not, which is in essence a theory of defense instruction, whether or not the defendant reasonably believed that a particular statement would or would not influence the financial institution is relevant to your determination of whether the defendant acted knowingly with the intent to influence the financial institution. If a defendant reasonably believed that a statement would not influence the financial institution, that statement cannot form the basis for a finding that the defendant knowingly made a false statement with the intent to influence a financial institution. How can that not be a correct statement of the law?
But
that instruction was denied.
But you're not claiming instructional error,
no.
As I understand it, in this
That's
case.
Correct.
This is an evidentiary issue.
That's right.
And the jury was properly instructed on the elements of the offense in the statute, the intent element and the purpose element, as I understand it.
That's right, Judge Sykes. We, as always occurs, we made some strategic decisions about which arguments we would bring before this court.
Right, but to the point of prejudice, was the case argued by the prosecution on a theory that submission of a loan application containing a false statement is conclusive proof?
Yes.
Of intent or purpose?
Absolutely. Here's their closing argument. The second count is count two, and that's the actual crime of submitting a false loan application to a bank. There's actually a crime if you submit a false loan application to a bank and the bank is federally insured. You've committed a crime. That's their argument.
That's the theory of the prosecution. We've been talking about the theory of the defense here, but the theory of the prosecution essentially rewrote the statute.
That's correct.
And so even though the jury was properly instructed on the elements, and there's nothing wrong with what the court did with respect to the law in submitting the case to the jury, prosecution argument basically transformed the statute into a false loan application statute.
That's right, Your Honor, and I would reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Graber.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Dan Graber. I represented the government at the trial. Seated with me at counsel's table is Assistant United States Attorney Alice Green. She's the appellate chief for our office. Lacey Phillips and Aaron Hall were not suckers that fell victim to a predatory subprime lender and a corrupt mortgage broker. These were two individuals who participated in a plan with Brian Bowling to submit false information on
this
a loan.
This sounds like a jury argument.
Correct.
What you're saying sounds to me a lot like a jury argument. Could you address the question of law that's presented here?
Sure, Your Honor. The first point is, the defense's argument is, did the judge err in precluding their defense, their subjective materiality defense?
Can I sharpen the question? It's not a materiality thing. Let me suggest two different statutes. One statute makes it a crime, has two elements. One, knowingly making a false statement, and two, to a federally insured lender. That's it. The second statute makes it a crime, knowingly to make a false statement to a federally insured lender for the purpose of influencing the lender. Now, do you think those statutes are one and the same?
The statute that we charge 1014.
I am asking you whether under the reason I'm trying to isolate this is, as I see your argument, you think that 1014 has been violated if a false statement has knowingly been made and it's been submitted to a federally insured lender. Now, when I read 1014, there's another clause in there, a clause that says, for the purpose of influencing in any way. So there's a third element. I want to know from you whether the government thinks that that element is just surplus, it doesn't make any difference, because your argument seemed to be as soon as that false statement was down on the application and the application was submitted to the bank, that was it. It didn't matter if the false statement was about somebody's age or weight or their last known address or their income or anything. You think it's enough to have a false statement in a form and then to give it to the bank.
That was not our position nor our understanding, Your Honor. There are four elements to that crime, and the third element requires intent to influence.
And you, why did you exclude all, why did you object to all of the evidence that would show their, the defendant's purpose?
Because the defendant was trying to argue, negate the element of intent to influence by saying, we didn't believe the lies were material. We know we lied.
But that's evidence of, if you think something is completely beside the point and you write it down on a form, because forms are stupid and they sometimes ask for crazy things. And so it asks, you know, what your weight was. And so you lie about your weight. You could say, I didn't think it was going to make any difference, but that's at least evidentiary toward whether you had any purpose to influence the recipient of that form.
And our position, Your Honor, was that the materiality is not an element of this crime.
And no one says it is. I think you're off on the wrong track. You aren't looking at their frame of mind, which is the problem. You're looking at what would make a difference to the bank.
Your Honor, what we were looking at was Wells. This argument
and,
came
and
up in Wells.
Materiality, I mean, that, it may be a subtle difference, but in materiality you're talking about, is this something that would tend to make the bank go one way or the other? And with purpose, it's something that is in the mind of the applicant for the loan.
And, Your Honor, in Wells, this argument came up with the subjective materiality, being able to bring materiality in to graft it to the third element. And the majority rejected that claim. What Justice Stevens in Wells was trying to argue was the point you're arguing, which is the statute 1014, if you don't bring materiality in as a separate standalone element, then you've got to graft it back into the intent to influence prong, because otherwise the statute's too big and it sweeps up people that make trivial false statements and they're subject to prosecution under 1014. In the Supreme Court, the majority said, no, you don't.
Right, and they're talking about something different. They're saying with the statute that already has a purpose requirement, you don't need a materiality requirement, too. Congress writes the statutes the way it wants to write them.
And so you can't bring materiality into the back door through the third element, Your Honor. And what the Supreme Court's saying is that nexus, that's the mechanism that protects against the prosecution of trivial statements.
Right, but I think that there's a perfect overlap. And what I'm concerned about is that people might think that something's material that's utterly beside the point, or they might think that something is utterly beside the point when it's material. There's a difference between purpose to influence on the applicant side and materiality on the bank side.
And our position was the materiality, Your Honor, wasn't by them saying we're entitled to lie because we didn't think the lies were going to influence the bank, the lies weren't going to hurt us. That doesn't negate intent to influence. That what that negates is intent to defraud. What you're saying is I didn't think I was going to hurt the bank, that I wasn't going to cause, because the bank was in on it.
That's a different phrasing. They said we didn't have a purpose to influence the bank. That's different from predicting whether the bank would be influenced or not.
But we're talking about what their argument was, a materiality
argument.
Their argument
is a purpose argument.
Well, what
they were trying to make it be a materiality argument, but they have been desperately trying to tell you, no, that's not our argument.
Your Honor, I would disagree with that. I believed my motion in limine.
What if the bank had said, what if Bowling had said to them, the bank has approved your loan, and it wants you to write down a few things, fill out a few things. Would that be purpose of influencing?
If the defendants filled out a loan.
Answer my question.
I don't know what the false application. What was false on the application, Your Honor?
Pardon?
What was false? That they jacked up the income to
$96,000? They tell Phillips and Hall, your application has been approved. Now, the bank wants you to put down X, Y, Z, and suppose, you know, Y is false. Now, are they guilty of trying to influence the bank when they've been told that the loan has been approved?
Well, if the loan's been approved, there wouldn't be
I don't understand why you can't answer yes or no.
The answer would be no, it wouldn't be a prosecution because the loan application wouldn't be necessary because they approved the loan already.
Okay, thank you. Now, I have another question. Suppose we're having lunch and I say to you, I have a toothache that's killing me. Now, would you call 911?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Why not?
I guess I don't understand the question. To call 911.
Pretty simple question. You say you wouldn't call 911.
Go ahead and
I'm
call 911.
I'm asking you why not. I told you my toothache is killing me. Why don't you call 911?
I wouldn't. That's usually not considered an emergency, having a toothache.
Well, dying is an emergency. I've told you this toothache is killing me. Now, why aren't you calling 911?
Answer that question.
You're totally out to lunch because your theory about why Bowling shouldn't have been permitted to testify what he told them about the borrower's loan line, you assume that all statements are literal. All meanings are literal. And if you believe that, then when I tell you toothache is killing me, you call 911. But obviously, most meanings are not literal. So if Bowling says to these inexperienced people, when the line says borrower's income, what it means is your income plus the income of anybody else, which would be available to pay the loan. Spouse, your girlfriend that you're planning to marry, your parents, you put that down. That's what it means. It doesn't say that. It's what it means. Now, what's wrong with that? A figurative meaning.
Two things. One, they could have said whatever they wanted to say about what they believed the loan application required them to do. In this case, they lied on the loan application by increasing the income amount to $96,000
in
the job.
No, that's a separate point because they said Bowling did that without their knowledge. I'm just talking about what Bowling told them about the borrower's line. The borrower's line, borrower's income includes this other income, included Hall's income. Now, is that such a fantastic interpretation that Phillips, Paul, should not be able to argue to a jury that that's what he told us and we believed him?
That evidence did get in, Your Honor. The evidence did get in. If you look on the cross-examination of Bowling, Mr. Wilson got in. I think it's record site 150, page 122. He got out the fact that Bowling said it was a stated income loan, that we could keep Aaron off this loan application, that we could combine the incomes. And then he stated, but we're going to have to state Lacey's income up so she can qualify by herself, and we're going to have to do it high enough to get the loan, about $96,000, and we're going to have to change her job because a hairdresser doesn't make $96,000, and he suggested a sales manager and wanted to know whether this employer star connection would back that up. And she said, well, that's my brother owns it. I'll see what he can do. In fact, she was able to get him to sign a false verification of employment form.
Those are separate points, but I understood you to be arguing and Judge Crabb to be ruling that the answer that they made a deliberately false statement in allowing Bowling to add Hall's income to Phillips.
And Judge Crabb did preclude them from making a defense in negating intent to influence. They could have.
For that, they needed to be able to cross-examine Bowling on that point.
To bring up their good faith reliance defense to create the materiality defense. What they wanted to say.
No, this is not materiality. This is a knowing false statement. If they believe that borrower's income line on the form actually means the borrower's income plus other income available to law, then they're not making a false, they're knowingly false statement.
There, two things. The facts, the income and the sales, there was no mistake. There was, they simply said that that didn't happen. At trial, they presented to the jury saying that Bowling never told them that, that that never happened. Bowling said that it happened. They said it didn't happen. And they argued to the jury it, that didn't happen. And the jury decided to believe Bowling.
Well, they had an opportunity to cross-examine Bowling to find out what exactly he said about the meaning of borrower's income.
Which goes into the materiality defense.
No, no. It goes into whether there's a knowingly false statement. If they think borrower's income means borrower's income plus other people's income, then they're not making a knowingly false statement.
But what their defense was, that wasn't their defense. Their defense was it never happened, that he never told us this.
Their defense as restricted by the court's rulings, but they were certainly trying very hard to bring this other dimension that there was no purpose on their part when these things were done to influence the bank.
Which was what we were arguing, Your Honor.
And you converted that every time they tried to say that into a materiality to the bank issue, but they were trying to say we don't have a purpose.
We were saying it goes to materiality because that was what, number one, and number two.
So do you think evidence in general in your experience is pertinent always just to one hermetically sealed off issue?
Well, Your
evidence
Honor,
is frequently, you know, something that throws light on a number of different things. It may throw light on materiality, but if materiality is not in the statute, who cares? It may also throw light on purpose. I think you have a very restrictive notion of relevance.
Your Honor, the way we teed it up in front of the court was saying, motion in limine, you're not allowed to bring Brian Bowling's, you want to bring a materiality defense in front of the jury by saying Brian Bowling told us it was okay to lie. We were entitled to lie.
Did you ever talk about purpose? Did you ever even entertain the thought that this evidence might pertain to the purpose that they had when these forms were filled out, particularly Ms. Phillips?
It was talked about a lot because
and no evidence came in on it, which is why the trial winds up being structured as it is.
Well, I'm talking about the pretrial hearing in front of Judge Kravitz.
I know, and she kept out evidence that would have been pertinent to purpose because she thought, at your urging, that it was really only about materiality. That's my problem.
Because of the Wells decision, Your Honor. Because
but
Wells
doesn't go that far. We've all seen Wells.
Wells doesn't allow you to what they were trying to do, which is backdoor materiality in through the third element intend to influence.
That's an overreading of the decision. Wells was a statutory interpretation case. It wasn't an evidentiary ruling. It didn't foreclose the introduction of evidence on materiality to the extent that that understanding on the part of the defendants entails the same evidence. It just said there isn't an element of materiality in the statute, and we don't need to imply one to save it from a due process challenge. That's all Wells stands for. It doesn't categorically exclude evidence of materiality when it's offered from the perspective of what the defendants understood or knew.
And
that's where the legal error in the understanding of what the argument was occurred, both on your part and the district judges. You were talking past each other, and there's a lot of that going on here today, too.
And, Your Honor, we don't believe there was legal error because it went what their defense was going to was we're entitled to lie. It's okay. The bank thinks it's okay because of the nature.
It wasn't a mistake of law defense. It was a mistake of facts defense to the extent that the evidence they wanted to offer related to whether they knowingly made a false statement, and secondarily, and perhaps more importantly, to the purpose element of the offense. Being foreclosed from introducing that evidence, it seems to me, was prejudicial because of the way you argued the case, which was that their submission of a false loan application or a loan application containing a false statement was conclusive proof of their purpose, and nothing more is necessary.
And I didn't argue it that way, Your Honor. The snippet he's taking out was just a snippet of the overall argument. I didn't say conclusive proof. I explained that when you sign a loan application that you know has false information on it, and you know it's, that loan application is going to the bank,
well,
and you submit it to
the evidence that they knew there was false information? Just what the FBI agent testified that Hall told
Brian Bowling testified that he told them. Oh. They admitted to the FBI agent that they knew it was on the false loan application, that false information was on the loan application. They also knew because they had gone to Associated Bank and told the truth and were denied.
Mr. Graber,
Mr. Graber, is it your understanding that the defense is trying to present evidence from Bowling that what was told to them would be irrelevant to the bank? Do you understand that to be their position?
Correct, Your Honor.
Now let me just go to Wells, which is the foundation stone of your analysis, it seems. And Wells says a statement, quote, for the purpose of influencing, obviously a quote from the statute, a bank will not usually be something about which a banker would regard as trivial. And certainly could all agree with that. What if it says it's irrelevant? I mean, that's their theory, right? So does Wells cover a position taken by a defendant that they've been told to present irrelevant information, albeit inaccurate or false?
So if they make a false statement and they thought it was irrelevant?
If their theory, I don't know what Bowling's going to testify to because he didn't get to this point. If Bowling says, look, you can get this loan, you've got to put this down, but what you put down is irrelevant. Do what I tell you, including Ms. Rapp, but it's irrelevant because the loan is going through. Does Wells cover that? Wells talks about trivial.
Correct.
Trivial has some meaning. Irrelevant has no meaning, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And for example, they could have negated the intent to influence element a number of different ways. We were just saying they're precluded from doing it by arguing materiality, that they thought
that's not what Wells says. I'm looking at some language from Wells right now. As Judge Sykes pointed out, first the court says there's no risk of criminalizing too much for 1014. The language makes a false statement to one of the enumerated financial institutions a crime only if the speaker knows the falsity of what he says and intends it to influence the institution. A statement made for the purpose of influencing a bank will not usually be about something a banker would regard as trivial, and it will be relatively rare, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on. So Wells itself recognizes the relevance from an evidentiary point of view of this package of evidence we're talking about to the purpose element. Wells doesn't say you can never talk about something that might have some application to materiality as well.
Well, in Your Honor, I guess
Wells knits them together, actually, very neatly.
And it's our understanding or belief that Wells is saying, I think that if you follow with the phrase that you were just quoting from, hence the literal reading of the statute will not normally take the scope of 1014 beyond the limit that a materiality requirement would impose. So the Supreme Court is saying that nexus requirement is the mechanism so you don't need materiality.
Because purpose is going to do it. It's going to be relatively rare. They're saying a statement made for the purpose that's identified isn't usually going to be about something that's immaterial, although there's always a possibility that it would be.
And what
people might think, you know, that if they put on their application form that their uncle is the president of the bank, it'll be material. And it may not, you know, may influence. Maybe that was with the purpose of influencing, but this bank has fantastic, you know, nepotism safeguards, and it wouldn't influence at all. It wouldn't be material.
In our position,
forgive me, but what if the bank?
Have you finished your answer, sir?
Yes, Your Honor, I have.
What if? I forgot my question. What if someone from the bank, from, you know, Fremont, told them, "Look, combine your income." And because what matters to us is the total income that's available to repay the loan. Would the defendant still be guilty under 1014?
If the defendants made false statements, and in this case lying about the income and the job, and they did that with the intent to influence the bank.
And at the instruction of the bank.
At
But knowing that prior, when they went to Associated Bank, they told the truth and were denied.
But you're not answering Judge Roebner's question.
Well, what I'm trying to get at, though, is that if you've got a dirty banker telling you it's okay to do that, it's immaterial.
No. You know, someone from the bank. They don't know if he's dirty, if he's clean.
You don't know whether all banks have the same requirements.
So well, but if the banker's telling you that it's okay to lie, if the banker's telling you that you can put a loan application.
That's the question. What about Mr. Wilson's example? You're embarrassed about your weight, so you subtract a few pounds from your weight. It's not that you're grossly obese and therefore a health, unlikely to survive to pay off the loan. You're just a little heavy, and maybe you're in some field where you want to look young and so on. So you take a few pounds off.
I would argue that's a proper way to negate the intent to influence prong by saying embarrassment. I lied, but I did it. My motive was embarrassment. For example, Lacey could have said, we kept Aaron off because Aaron wasn't reporting all of his income on the tax returns. He was cheating, and we were afraid if we told the truth, the IRS would come after us. Okay, now you've got self-preservation. You've got other reasons as to why you're lying. Our point was, but you can't get into the reason being, we didn't think the lies mattered because Brian Bowling, the broker, told us, because under the stated income loan program, it's okay to lie.
But there are other pieces of information forms ask for. Maybe you have a better experience with forms than some of us. But there are pieces of information that really seem completely beside the point. I can see what you're saying about embarrassment being a positive reason why you may do it. But suppose, you know, the form also asked, you know, what church did your grandfather go to or something like that? Nothing to do with you. Or, you know, did he sing in the glee club? Forms ask for really dumb things, and people might fill it out and think this is not going to have any impact. I'm not going to be influencing the bank, but they're asking for this information.
That's what
they're trying to say, that Mr. Bowling told them that this information was. It was utterly beside the point.
But they weren't going down the road of self-preservation, trying to protect embarrassment.
Beside the point. How about that?
Which was a materiality. They were saying the lies didn't matter, Your Honor.
All right.
But if the lies don't matter, then how are they influencing the bank?
Why do they have a purpose to influence the bank by telling them what time the sun rose this morning? That's the question. Why would you have a purpose to tell somebody something that was irrelevant?
And our point is they knew they were influencing the bank because
that's
Brian Bowling told them,
this is
what you need to do, Your Honor, these are the things you need to do to get the loan. And, in fact, they knew that because when they told the truth to the Associated, they didn't get the loan.
So that's your theory, but you kept out the evidence of their theory.
We kept out a very narrow theory, which was that we're entitled to lie because Brian Bowling told us it was okay to lie, that we wouldn't get caught, that the bank was in on it.
Suppose one section of the loan application actually said, quote, this portion of the application will not affect the decision on your loan, end quote. And in that section, the bank asks the applicant's maiden name, and the applicant writes down the wrong name. Would that person be in violation of 1014?
Did the person read that disclaimer saying it doesn't matter?
It says right there, this portion of the application will not affect the decision on your loan. They're then asked some questions. One of the questions is, what was your maiden name? And the applicant writes down the wrong maiden name. Maybe they think the bank is going to do some credit check on the family or something like that, whatever, but they see that the bank says it doesn't matter. So why is that? Would that person be in violation of 1014?
If the person... No, because they didn't have an intent to influence the bank with the false statement.
Right. But someone telling them, you're drawing a distinction between someone telling them, like the crooked broker, that they could give misinformation and it would not matter to the bank.
I'm saying that's
really a difference. You're trying to draw a distinction there.
When the broker or a loan officer is telling you, under this program, it's okay to lie. You're entitled to lie because you won't get caught because the loan's going to go through.
No, it's the difference between whether you get caught and whether you're told it won't matter. It won't matter.
The bank doesn't care.
Because the bank will not be influenced by it.
At that point.
And our argument, Your Honor, is that the materiality, that's not an element under Wells. That
really,
you can't negate
really
the intent.
You're really hung up on materiality. You've used that word about 40 times. The reason I keep coming back to this question, what did they understand by borrower's income, is that that is clearly something that Phillips and Hall knew. They knew that they were this line was going to contain both of their incomes. They knew that. It's not something that they say, you know, Bowling just did on his own without telling them. And I don't really understand your answer to it. Couldn't they have believed that borrower's income meant borrower's income plus the other income available to pay?
That evidence was presented to the jury. And they made the argument that it was Brian Bowling's idea, that he was the one that put it down, and that we had no...
No.
Did they increase the amount of money?
They knew that the borrower's income was going to be her income and his income.
Did they raise the amount of money on the income from what was real?
Correct. The combined income was $54,000.
That's a separate point. They say that the amount that was put on it was Bowling's doing. But they admit that they knew that line was going to contain his income as well as her income. And they weren't allowed to cross-examine Bowling to get him to in the hope that he would say, well, what he told them was that borrower's income means borrower's income plus other income available to pay.
They actually got that out through his cross-examination. They did, and that was presented to the jury. And then they went, took that and said, and therefore it was all his idea and we had nothing to do with it. So they made that argument to the jury. They got that evidence in front of the jury and made that argument.
So what was the cross-examination that was barred?
The next point that Brian said, under this program, that's okay to do, that these are liar loans and it's okay to lie, you're going to get the loan, you're not going to get caught. That is what we wanted excluded and precluded because that went to a lack of intent to defraud defense, a lack of intent to break the law defense, and the materiality defense.
What if he had said, not that this is a liar's loan, but that what the bank means by this is your income plus other income. If they just got that in, wouldn't that be material, or wouldn't it? That's material in your sense. Wouldn't that be relevant evidence?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, my time is up. Can I?
You can always answer a judge's question.
That our position would be that would not be material because that would be going to the defenses of lack of intent to defraud.
So you're totally missing the point. If all Bowling would say was, I told them that the term borrower's income means borrower's income plus other income available.
He did not tell him that. What he said...
Just answer my question. If that's what he told them, then wouldn't that be relevant to whether they knowingly made a false statement?
It would be, Your Honor, and that wasn't
right.
The subject of our...
It would be. Thank you. That's my question.
Okay.
And you've answered it.
But that wasn't this...
And you've answered it.
Your time has now expired. Anything further, Mr. Wilson?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I wanted to pick up on a point that I think Judge Wood was making, and I agree with, which is that the Wells decision, even though it holds that materiality is not an element of the offense, nonetheless doesn't foreclose the fact that materiality might be relevant in the Rule 401 circumstantial evidence sense of the word.
And, in fact, when Justice Souter wrote what he did, that Judge Flom, the paragraph you were referring to, he was taking that directly from the government's brief in Wells, in which the government said, a defendant's intent to influence a bank's actions will usually be established as an inference from the actual materiality of the false statement itself.
You can use that word materiality a lot because it apparently irks somebody.
The other point I'd like to make is from the Lane case, which is the primary case from the Seventh Circuit upon which the government relies, because in that case, the government, in fact, made the same point that we're making today.
Let me ask you what you think this testimony would have shown. Now, I can think of two kinds of things that you might have wanted to get out of the loan broker. One kind of statement would be, your income just doesn't matter to, the statements about your income just don't matter to the bank. The second kind of thing is, the truth of the representations about income don't matter to the bank. Which one do you think he was going to say, the first or the second?
The former.
That he was going to say that he told them that if the line had just been left blank, the bank would have made the loan.
No, what I'm saying is that his testimony would have been on cross-examination. I told these lenders that your income won't influence the bank's decision.
Well, but isn't that ambiguous between these two things? If he's saying banks just don't care about borrowers' income, then presumably they could leave the line blank and have an equal chance of getting the loan. If, on the other hand, what he's saying is banks don't care about whether the statement of income is true or not, and that's why I can put them together and double, and that's a different proposition. That's why I want to know which of these you think it would be, because it seems to me that one of these, the first of these, would tend to negate intent to influence the bank, because it would be a representation that the line could be blank and bank wouldn't care. But the second would be quite consistent with intent to influence the bank.
I agree.
Because then what you're saying is what the bank wants to do is syndicate this loan, but in order to syndicate the loan, it's got to have a minimum number on this line.
Right. And in fact, Judge, the
so
bank...
So which would he have said?
It's the former, not the latter.
And you think that's clear in the offer of proof?
Yes.
In the pretrial offer
yes.
of proof?
Yes. And in fact, the bank insider cases that Mr. Graber referenced, that's the distinguishing factor in those cases. In those cases, the bank insider said, submit this false information because we need it. In other words, to make the paperwork look right. But we don't care what it says. That's the second proposition you said.
That's the second proposition.
That's exactly right. And that's what distinguishes those cases from this case, which is that we are going to elicit testimony from Mr. Bowling that the income and the details on this loan didn't matter, would not influence the bank, which comes directly from the element of the statute itself. And what these defendants thought about what would or would not influence the bank, what was or was not important to the bank, what was in their own heads, is much different than what was in the bank's head when it approved the loan. And the point I would like to make about the Lane case is that that case draws the same distinction. And in fact, the government in that case, the same Department of Justice that's sitting here today, in arguing that the evidence that Mr. Lane wanted to introduce was irrelevant, they pointed out how none of that information had been communicated to Mr. Lane. In contrast, the government didn't object to the admission of information about the bank to the extent it had been communicated to Mr. Lane. So I'm going to read from page 32 of their brief. The evaluations by the bank were relevant, it's the government's brief, only to the extent that such evaluations were communicated to defendant, either orally or in writing, such as the loan documents. All evidence of such communications was admitted. In other words, if Mr. Lane knew what the bank was thinking, and for some reason that caused him to think what I'm submitting here won't influence the bank, that comes in. That's the evidence that was precluded in this case. And the point I would like to make is, in looking at these facts, and I'm not arguing their guilt or innocence, it is easy in doing this as long as all of you have, to become cynical. And I think a certain amount of cynicism crept into the trial in this case. And I think that the great thing about the fact that
every judge should wash his eyes with cynical acid.
There was a certain amount of cynicism about the defense, Your Honor. And I think that the privilege that you all have and the fact that there are 11 of you here today to hear a case about a barber and a hairdresser from Madison who have already served their time is that you have the privilege of getting it right. And that's all we're asking for is a fair trial. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And, Mr. Wilson, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment and that of your co-counsel and your assistance to the court as well as to your client. The case is taken under advisement.